to a whole. Okay, there we go. Yeah. Okay, so we are continuing on our study of the Psalms. Pastor John started us with Psalm 1 last week, and these two Psalms, Psalm 1 and 2, are really pivotal for understanding the whole of the Psalms and more the Bible. In the last Psalm, Pastor John especially talked about, I meditate on his law day and night, how important it is to meditate. Today we're going to look on, who are we meditating on, the object of the word, as Pastor Jared was talking about in John, in our morning reading, that the word became flesh. So let's start, Psalm 2. In 1882, renowned German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche penned three words that would shake the foundation of Western society. He said, God is dead. That's some bold words, right? What he meant was that society no longer needed the idea of God to function. To progress as a society, we should come out from under these moral shackles that we've put on ourselves and make our own meaning. In some ways, Nietzsche's words were not new ones. It's been in the heart of man since the fall to want to usurp God. So our question is, what does God have to say to somebody like this? Somebody who wants to rebel, these kings, these rulers, as has affected our society. That's the subject of our text today. And our main point is that God says to worship the Son. That's what he says to these rulers. So we'll break our text into the following. First, we'll see a foolish rebellion in verses 1 through 4. Then we'll sing a worthy king, verses 5 through 9. And then we'll finally see a choice given, verses 10 through 12. So that's a foolish rebellion, verses 1 through 4, a worthy king, 5 through 9, and then finally a choice given, verses 10 through 12. For some context on this verse, this would be sung, as we've sung today, at a coronation. So when King David, most likely wrote the psalm, but when other kings of Israel would become king, they would sing this. But not only is it for that current king of Israel, but it's looking forward to a greater king. We even see this in some of the first lines. Why do the nations rage? The kings of the earth set themselves? So this is a grander scale than just whoever's around Israel at that time. He's looking at the whole earth. And so I hope you're not surprised that this greater king that they're being pointed to is Jesus. I'm letting the cat out of the bag early, so don't be shocked. But that's my goal of this sermon, just to see how intimately Jesus fills everything in this text. So first, let me read the first chunk. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Our first question is, what are they raging at? Rage is such a strong emotion. What could cause somebody to act this way? Not only that, their raging is presumed. Let's see. It says, the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together. Against who? Against the Lord and against his anointed. So we see the rage. It's not hard to see that in our society, the wars that happen, the way that we disrespect one another. But it goes against that. It's not only against one another, human to human, but human to God is who our rage is against. Who are they raging again? It's against the Lord, but also his anointed. It's both. We'll come to that idea again. Who is the anointed? That's the same word as used for Messiah. In Greek, it's Christ. Obviously, we call Jesus Christ. That's a title of his. An anointed is the same as to be set apart, to be holy. So when something was anointed, say in Solomon's temple, you would pour holy oil on it to separate it from the rest of everything else. That this is set apart for a holy use. And a couple things that are important would be anointed, or people in particular. You would anoint prophets, you would anoint priests and kings. And we'll come back to that idea. Is it presumptuous to say that the king's rage against the Lord and his anointed, especially when we're talking on a global scale, many people don't even know who Jesus is. We hope that they will know his name. But we see in Romans 1:18 that nobody is excused from this. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. So these rulers know that there's an authority above. I'm sure you guys have felt it too. Why do we feel guilt? Even since we were a baby, or if we do something in secret and nobody is around to see it, we still feel something in us. And guilt is just a thought of, this should deserve punishment, right? We're under somebody else's rule, somebody else's authority. So what do the nations do about this? Their solution is to set themselves. Verse 2, it says the kings of the earth set themselves. Literally, that means to take your stand. So we think about maybe the Tower of Babel. They're making themselves big. They're trying to go as high as they can. But what does God, well, I guess we'll get to that. To set yourself. We see this in society, trying to make your own standard for right and wrong. If you have more and more authority, you have more authority to tell others what to do. You're trying to make yourself top dog. Make your own meaning. Sin is always a little bit further than what we're doing, right? If you watch one more episode of a show, it's only an episode further before it becomes binge watching, right? I was reading this blog kind of tearing down a pastor from the other side of the world. And in his idea, he was standing up for the little dog. He wasn't, you know, profaning or talking bad about another brother. So we twist our idea of what is good and what is evil. And this is what the kings are doing. They set themselves. Secondly, they take counsel together. If we read back in Psalms 1, which Psalm 2 will constantly be referring back to, this is the same word used when the author says, I meditate on your law. That word meditate. So while in Psalm 1, people are meditating on the law, something higher than them, a bigger authority found in God, these kings and rulers are meditating on themselves and taking counsel together. We see this in modern counseling. Modern counseling can only affirm what you're doing. There's no teeth to it. And then what is the goal of all of this? Why are they trying to set themselves? We see this in verse 3. Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. They don't want to be under God's authority. But when God is removed, there is no source of authority. The church just becomes pithy moralisms. You don't really have to follow it. It's just some good ideas. Democracy is just what everyone else thinks is right. And so we see, taken to the extreme, stuff like Nazi Germany, where everyone said it's okay to do these actions, and who is to go against it? It's kind of like if you're in space and you say, I don't need a spacesuit. You're just stuck in void. It's groundless. There's nothing to stand on if you try to remove God's authority. So I want to ask you guys, what do you build your authority on? Maybe something to ask each other over lunch is, when's the last time that you really changed your mind about something? Maybe you thought one thing and then it switched and then something changed and you think differently now. What was the authority that caused that switch? Because there's always something. Maybe it could be a verse. It could be something a friend said. Maybe an action that you saw that clarified something. So where does your authority come from? What do you see as sufficient evidence to believe something? And then finally, why is this rebellion that people are casting, why is it foolish? Well, there's a physical difference that is drawn in this passage. It says, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Heaven is above us, and we can't even... God is infinite. I think there are a few things to see physically what infinity is like, but when you look up at the sky, it just keeps going. We think about, you know, in Babel, they wanted to get higher to reach God in heaven. nowadays, we have astronauts who have gone to space. They've reached the top of heaven, and it keeps going. So even physically, the kings and all of their pomp and circumstance trying to set themselves, taking their stand, are not even close to God as he sits. We can take away from this that we shouldn't put our hope in any politicians or human events or causes, because that's not the ultimate authority. God is. I love how the abolitionist movement has done this. So the abolitionist movement is an anti-abortion cause. Michael and I and a couple other people in college, we would go out and talk to people on campus explaining why it's wrong to abort babies, and seeing that they're made in the image of God. But that wasn't all that we were doing. If we were to just convince somebody's mind of one particular topic, the rest of their thinking, their worldview, is unchanged. What they need is to see God's authority, and that will change everything else that they think. This is also why we pray for people in authority, as we did this morning. We pray for our rulers, one, because they're tempted to set themselves up to want to gain power, but also they're representing nations and people that are not looking for God's authority. So the fact that anything is done justly is truly a miracle and a gift from God. So that was a foolish rebellion. A second, a worthy king. So what gives somebody authority? We've used this word a lot. Jonathan Lehman has been very helpful in this topic. There's a little book just simply called Authority, and he defines it this way. Authority is, first, you have power, so the ability to do something. I can pick up this water bottle, I can speak to you. I have the power to do it, but I also need a right or license to do it, to make decisions with that power. So I think about, I remember having breakfast with a family, and they had these little kids, and the parents had to go upstairs, so I was with them. And the kid, this girl, Abby, she walks up to the fridge and she grabs a yogurt, and she knows she's not supposed to, and I'm not sure if she's allowed to. So she has the power to eat that yogurt right then and there. But she knows that she's under authority, right? So I ask, are you able to eat that yogurt? And she says, ah, my dad, he said that I can have whatever I want. I can eat this yogurt. So she appealed to a higher authority. I was fooled because I believed her. And so she got to enjoy her yogurt and ruined her breakfast. So, but this is what we do with authority. We don't have true authority if it's not in God, and so we twist it and make it our own and try to redefine it so that we can make it ours. So what gives God or the Son this authority? Let's read the full section, 5-9. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. So this is the son's case of authority. First of all, I love how this starts. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury. What would terrify a king? Somebody who's already seized so much power. What would make them quake? It says that God has already chosen a king. As for me, I've set my king on Zion, my holy hill. That means that one who has seized power, seized authority that they shouldn't have, is now terrified because it's going to be taken away. There's somebody who does have proper authority, being Jesus. So what authority does he have? First, he's chosen by God, as we've seen. He's been set by God, unlike these other kings who have set themselves. The nations and the earth are given to him at the very end. So it's a gift. Jesus, technically speaking, already owns these, right? If he's the third person of the Trinity, God, he sustains the creation of the world, and it is part of making all of it. But him being given this authority in a legal sense is really important to his right to it, because he puts his authority under God's. Next, he's prophet, priest, and king. God says, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, so that's very clear. Zion is my holy hill. So Zion is just an area that represents what would be the temple of Solomon. So the king is ruling from a place of spiritual authority at the temple. He's a priest. But in verse 7, the climax of the passage, he says, I will tell of the decree the Lord said to me. So this king is speaking on God's behalf. When he says, I will tell the decree, whose decree is it? Is it the Lord's or is it his? Yes, it's both. Their motives are intertwined there. Let's see. Next, he's begotten. He's equal with the Son and the Father. So it says, you're my Son, today I have begotten you. Some people have understood this as, Jesus was created. When reading this in its original context, yes, maybe it was showing a status that the king had. So the king would be talked about as a son of God, but Jesus is literally the Son, and he's a begotten Son. So think about, you might beget a child, but you don't beget a painting, because a child is built of your same parts. You share flesh and blood, you share DNA. But a painting is something other outside of you. The begotten also shows that the Son is equal to the Father. In the beginning, that the nations are against both the Father and the Son equally. So again, they're united in that. And then finally, the Son is shown to be equal in power to God because he trusts that the Son will be able to rule capably over the nations and over the ends of the earth. I can, you know, barely keep my room in order, much less all the nations, and yet the Son is able to do that to show that he's equal with the Father. This verse, you're my Son, today I've begotten you, is actually quoted in Acts 13:33 when Paul is talking to some Israelites. He says, but God raised him from the dead, being Jesus, and for many days he appeared to those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses to the people. I'll skip ahead. This has been fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus, as also it is written in the second psalm, you are my Son, today I've begotten you. So this begetting is a status that Jesus takes on. When Jesus rose from the dead, he proclaimed, I have this status. I have the power over sin and death. So let's finally move on to the Son's power. Yes. So authority without power is toothless. If the Son has the right to authority, he also needs to wield that authority, which is where we see in verse 9, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. This can be really hard for us to hear, especially when we think of Jesus as meek and lowly, and he is these things. He calls himself that. But he also has true power that he will use against these rebels, these kings. It describes it as having a rod of iron, meaning there's no bending from the law. And these are all good things for us to hear. Who likes a fickle ruler? Somebody who says, I'll let you slide this time, but then somebody else, wave the heavy hand. But Jesus isn't like that. He's fair and just. He rules with a rod of iron. But he's also decisive. He rules that rod of iron against these potter's vessels. So these kings that try to make themselves big, they call themselves indestructible, there's no match for this. It's as easy as smashing a metal pot. In Revelation 19:15, we see Jesus wielding this very rod against, as he wages war against kings that rise up against him. But how do we, as the church, think about his rod? Because there are good things for us. Actually, in Psalm 23:4, this rod pops up again. Even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So do you see this rod as a source of comfort for you? This is how one theologian put it. The shepherd's rod and staff were his implements for disciplining, rescuing, and protecting his sheep. They could be used to dissuade a sheep from going to a dangerous place or to break the skull of a serpent. Jesus wields this rod justly, and we should be thankful that he punishes unrighteousness, but he also uses it to guide us. So finally, a choice given. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all those who take refuge in him. So how do we respond to this kind of authority? We've seen who we should follow, namely the Son, Jesus. Why should we follow him? He's been given this authority, this divine right to rule over us. But then how should we follow him? I would argue the Son is not only worthy to be rule over us, and we should accept his rule, but we should worship him. What is worship? It's just the glorification of authority. Anything that we worship, we're saying, has sway on our lives in some aspect. And Jesus wants to have ultimate sway on our lives. We think about maybe when we're singing, as we've done today, we're recognizing God's authority over us as we sing, saying that these truths, I love you, Lord, that this is evident, or that he, you know, sits enthroned in heaven. But then we also do it with a joyful noise. It's a happy, you know, glorious kind of worship, or glorious kind of authority that we see. Even when we lift our hands, when you lift your hands up, are you doing it to wave around like you just don't care, like at a party? No, it's for surrender. You're saying, you have it all, Lord. I give it to you. You have authority over my life. So what are some specific ways that this worship looks like? First, we see that we're called to fear God. Let me read it. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. This is different from the terror that we see earlier when God speaks to the rulers and says, I will terrify them. He will terrify them in his fury. Terror drives you away from God. You want to escape the wrath of God. This fear is very different than most fear that we see throughout the world because it actually brings us closer. So I want to illustrate that with a couple of verses. Jeremiah 33:9, God is speaking to Israel. He has just given judgment upon them justly for their sins. But then he says that he'll rebuild them and says, they shall fear and tremble because of all the good and prosperity that I provide for it. That's the reason for fear and trembling. Jesus even does this in Luke 7:16. He rises a man from the dead, and as the crowd watches, it says, fear seized them all. And what did this do? They glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people. This is a fear that's unlike human fear or worldly fear. I think one of the best examples I've seen was in the Chronicles of Narnia, the Silver Chair. For some context, the protagonist, Jill, she comes to Narnia, but she's thirsty. So she's looking for a stream, and she finds one, and this is where we'll pick up. And it's a long passage, but a good one, so I'm going to quote it at length. Although the sight of the water made her feel 10 times thirstier than before, she didn't rush forward and drink. She stood as still as if she had turned into stone, with her mouth wide open, and she had a very good reason. Just on this side of the stream lay the lion. If I run away, it'll be for me at a moment, thought Jill. And if I go on, I shall run straight into its mouth. Anyway, she couldn't have moved if she had tried, and she couldn't take her eyes off of it. How long this lasted, she could not be sure. It seemed like hours. And the thirst became so bad, she almost felt she would not mind being eaten by the lion if only she could be sure of getting a mouthful of water first. If you are thirsty, you may drink. For a second, she stared here and there, wondering who had spoken. Then the voice said again, if you are thirsty, come and drink. It was deeper, wilder and stronger, a sort of heavy golden voice. It did not make her any less frightened than she had been before, but it made her frightened in rather a different way. "Are you not thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink," said the lion. "May I? Could I? Would you mind going away while I do?" said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. "Will you promise not to do anything to me if I come?" said Jill. "I make no promise," said the lion. "I daren't come and drink," said Jill. "Then you will die of thirst," said the lion. "Oh dear," said Jill, coming another step nearer. "I suppose I must go and look for another stream then." "There is no other stream," said the lion. So eventually Jill does step forward and take a drink, and she's satisfied by this water that she's been longing for. How does this show the fear of the Lord? Well, Jesus is like this lion, more importantly, like this stream, but he wants us to come to him rightly. If the lion wasn't there, Jill could have just waltzed up, you know, if the lion was caged, and taken some water for herself, but she wouldn't have experienced the lion. She wouldn't have known him any better than before. When she comes in the presence of this lion, she has to trust that what he's saying is true, that he's not lying when he says, you can come and drink. But she does so with fear, with reverence. Fear is a response, this is from Michael Reeves, I love this definition, to overwhelming, undeserved grace. We see this even in the last passages that we read, Jeremiah 33:9. Israel expected for the calamity of the Lord to fall upon them because they were judged rightly for their sins, but it didn't stop there. There was overwhelming grace that they experienced when he restored Israel or promised to restore Israel. Same in Luke 7:16. When somebody is raised from the dead, we don't expect that to happen. We realize that we are meant to die at some point, and we accept it. But when we're given life again, we're overwhelmed by that. Why was this grace given to us? Also see how Jill treats this experience of the lion. When you fear something, your eyes are locked on, you're forward. You're thinking about, what is this lion thinking? What is he like? You know, can I trust him? What are his words? In the same way that we think about Jesus, you're outside yourself thinking about how does, you know, God fulfill me, and you're thinking about him. You're rightly orientating your mind. So like the lion, God also does this with fear. You can't back out, but it's difficult to go forward. But he wants you to go forward in the right respect, so he's turning the dials, kind of wedging you in, bringing you closer to him through this fear, so that we'll be doing it rightly. In the Proverbs, it even says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's because of this, you know, vice-like training us towards being in the right attitude towards God that gives us wisdom. So that's one way that worship looks like. To see his authority rightly, with rejoicing and trembling, as this verse says. But then also, we take refuge in him. "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." So this actually refers, again, to Psalm 116, where it says, the wicked will perish. That's what we expect. That's their end. There's no debating it. It also says that it will come quickly and decisively. Does this go against God being patient? No, it just describes how his wrath works. So he's patient. Even in this verse, these kings are wicked. They rebel against him, but judgment doesn't come automatically. Instead, it'll come at a later time, but decisively. In 1 Thessalonians 5, 2-3, it says, "For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night, while people are saying, there's peace and security. Then suddenly destruction will come upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman and they will not escape. So we don't know when God's wrath is coming, but if you're in his wrath, if you're still in rebellion against him, it's guaranteed. So turn to him quickly. And then it also says, blessed are all those who take refuge in him. This is paralleling in Psalm 1, the beginning, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked. Turn from your wicked ways and take refuge in me. There's true security in him. God is not fickle. It wouldn't be true refuge if God were to turn around and suddenly strike you for no apparent reason. But he wields the rod, again, justly. So let's land this plane. This is so evident of the life of Jesus. When Jesus came to earth, he confronted the nations, and the nations rejected him. Not only the nations, but his own people rejected him. The Pharisees and the rulers, they mocked and shamed him. They spat on his authority and decided to orient or change his laws into what would best serve them and their motives. But when Jesus died, he put the power of sin to death, and he proclaimed that he really did have that authority. Again, the verse in Acts, this was his coronation, which, what a coronation, that after, at his weakest moment, he would be crowned king and be shown great to all these rulers. And because of this, Jesus is worthy to be worshiped fully with all our being. He is the person who mediates as prophet, priest, and king between us and God, and between God and us, which nobody else is able to do. And so he will, you know, rule the nations ultimately in the end, but as we wait for that now, we can go out confidently to the nations because he's king currently. So ask yourselves, will you turn from your rebellion and worship him? Where is this heart of rebellion in us? And will you rejoice with trembling? Will you come to him rightly? Not just to say, you know, okay, I'll do what you say, but rejoice in it, to love it, but love it with fear. So let's pray. Dear God, we thank you that you rule over us so mightily and so justly. I pray that you fill our hearts with the fear of the Lord, that it would overcome us and motivate everything that we do. In Jesus' name, amen.